Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, as the United States slaps 30% tariffs on South African exports, government is scrambling to shield car factories, but is it too little too late? Local clothing producers are being outpaced by imports, and policy silence is making it worse. That warning from the Localization Support Fund. South Africa's economy shows surprising strength in July, but risks still loom large. And Shell's ultra-deep oil drilling plan ignites legal fury. Civil society calls it reckless and unconstitutional. It's Thursday, the 7th of August. Now, government is moving quickly to shield South Africa's car factories and exporters from a damaging 30% tariff hike imposed by the United States. There are fears of job losses and factory closures, and these fears are mounting. Now, the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition has launched an urgent export support desk, has loosened competition rules to allow for industry collaboration, and is also pushing alternative markets. But one's got to ask the question, is this all too little too late? Joining me now is Kamil Ali, who speaks for the Minister of Trade, Industry and Competition. Kamil, welcome and thank you very much indeed. So maybe let's start with this. Just how worried is the DTIC right now, and how much damage could the 30% tariff actually do to the automotive sector in particular? What kind of quantifiable analysis have you done?
Well, good day to you, Jeremy, and good day to your listeners. Thank you very much for having me. It's been quite a difficult few months for the department and for South Africa as a whole. Since the announcement that a potential higher tariff on trading partners with the United States was announced, government had already begun work on trying to avert a potential crisis with a large number of our manufactured exports being destined for the United States, a large number of our agricultural products destined for the United States. There's been a number of different modeling exercises that have been done to try and figure out exactly where we should be intervening and what kind of interventions would be required in order to avert a crisis. Of course, our first prize was always and still remains a better deal, so to speak, with the U.S. government. We still believe that our historic trade relationship with the U.S. And what we have offered and the offer that we put on the table offers mutually beneficial trade terms for both the U.S. and South Africa. And be that as it may, it is the 7th today, and we still await a response from the U.S. on our trade deal.
You don't think that optimism right now is a little misguided as that clock is starting to tick, given the anger of the Trump administration towards Pretoria?
Well, the anger you speak of, Jeremy, has not been very adequately communicated to us, if it so is. But I don't think that optimism is a bad thing at this point in time. I think that we have to be quite deliberate in attempting on both fronts, the one front to try and secure what we need from the U.S., or secure the deal, so to speak, and on the other end to try and put in place measures that could avert a crisis. So I think it's important for us to attack it on both ends.
I fully understand that. Conventional wisdom would suggest, though, with Friday fast approaching, you're probably not going to hear from Washington. So what urgent contingency plans are in place right now?
Well, urgency is the key word here, Jeremy. And I think we've put in place as the first line of defense, the export support desk. This is a mechanism that we will utilize to interact with our exporters who are looking not only to diversify from the U.S., but also to see what support is in place for them for exports that are still destined for the US. That's the first one.
I've got to assume that Export Support Desk is now operational. What kind of calls is it getting, and what assistance have you been able to offer or advice?
You know, the calls that we've been receiving has been from the agriculture sector, which is understandable because of the nature of produce and products that are being sent into the US market, those being fresh products, which have a very short lifetime. We've been assured that any produce that is on the water and is scheduled to reach the US before the cutoff date will still make it in without the tariff applied to it, without the new tariff applied to it. And we've been communicating with our exporters that much.
But beyond that, what kind of assistance are you able to offer these exporters?
You know, we're able to, at this point in time, link them up with the other measures through the support desk, those being the competition measures that we've managed or that we're looking still to implement. You, I'd understand that would need to go through. In fact, the whole package would have needed to go through a cabinet process for approval. But it includes also the localization support fund, which stands ready to contribute to the national effort. The Industrial Development Corporation and other entities within the DTIC as well, you know, we're able to direct exporters to some of those to get support. So there's a holistic view on how we want to deal with this. But ultimately, you know, there is the reality that at some point we will need to create a more resilient trading relationship with our global partners. And that is one of the biggest focuses of the DTIC at this point in time.
But that's going to take a long time, understandably, to do. And in the short term, inevitably, then there are going to be casualties, aren't there?
Well, we're hoping to mitigate those with the support package, Jeremy. The Export Competitiveness and Support Program that we have within the DTIC is another lever that we have in the immediate term to prevent these casualties. We're also speaking very closely with the Department of Employment and Labor to see how through its entities they're able to intervene to particularly around the job losses, ensure that we're not compromised on that front. So government is taking an all of government approach in this, and we're not sort of sitting back and allowing this thing to happen to us.
Camille, of course, the reality of the situation is how long factories, whether they be in the automotive sector or in the agriculture sector, can actually absorb any kind of high cost before cutting jobs. And it would seem that's going to happen sooner rather than later.
Yeah, it's you know, I don't want to sort of butter up anything, you know, or paint a picture that's not true, because Jeremy, that is unfortunately a reality. Safe to say that as we roll out this program and as we gain some intelligence from the market and we do some modeling and some analysis, we'll be able to react accordingly. There's no sort of silver bullet to something like this. A unilateral tariff imposed by the United States is not something that any government, I think, has an immediate antidote to. So we do have to sort of ensure that we're taking in as much information in order to create the necessary mechanisms as we go along to avert a desperate crisis.
To the best of your knowledge, and this is a last question, is there any conversation happening right now between Pretoria and Washington as that implementation deadline is upon us?
At this point in time, what I can share is that we've bolstered our mission in Washington. To ensure that the conversations are happening at the right levels and in the right places. Further than that, I am not at liberty to share much more.
Camille Ali, thank you very much indeed. Speaks for the Minister of Trade, Industry and Competition.
Remember when you had to hurry up and wait, and cars could only run on fossil fuels? Well, hurry up and catch up. You don't need diesel power. You just need a second electric motor. With Volvo plug-in hybrids, you can drive electric in the city, switch to fuel for the long haul, or combine both when you want it all. So what are you waiting for? You're late for your test drive. It's safe to be brave with Volvo.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, they're fast, they are cheap, and probably taking over your Instagram feed. But at what cost? Offshore e-commerce giants like Shein and Temu are really rewriting the rules of fashion retail in South Africa. And a new report shows the local fallout is already serious. Billions lost in manufacturing and thousands of jobs that have probably never materialized. Now, the Localization Support Fund is sounding the alarm. And joining me to discuss the findings of the report and what needs to change is Arshad Katrada, who's Chief Executive Officer of the LSF. So, Arshad, a very warm welcome to you. Your report estimates nearly R1 billion lost in local manufacturing sales since 2020. What's your assessment here? Is this a warning or a wake-up call or both?
It is both a warning, it is a wake-up call, and it is an alarm as to the extent to which these offshore online players like Shein and Temu have disrupted local manufacturing and local retail sales in the clothing and textile sector, but also the extent to which they are disrupting the economy. I mean, as you said, there are jobs lost, so we've estimated that more than 8,000 jobs have already been lost as a result of the introduction of these players. Now, they've only come into the market over the last 4 to 5 years. They've garnered probably about 4% of market share. So to put that in context, Shein and Temu have now more market share than the likes of your H&M, Zara's, Cotton On's, all put together. And they've done that over a much, much faster time. And without the job creation and the economic multipliers that some of these other players have, not to mention the South African retailers who have a much more extensive network that include manufacturing as well. And so it really is something that we need to consider. And I think that's why we commissioned this report in the first instance, is that we knew at high level there is a disruption happening, but no one had to date put numbers to this, certainly not around the sales that have been lost and the economic impact in terms of jobs. And I think we need to understand where we are as a first point.
So let me play devil's advocate here. Surely these two brands simply saw a convenience gap in the market, which local players either failed to see or have been too slow to react to.
Look, in part they did, but in part they also exploited a loophole. And so a lot of the goods that were coming into the country came in as what is often being called small parcels. And those small parcels, up until about September, November last year, were not attracting the same duties and that local players are subject to, which means that they weren't on a equal playing field. And so they exploited that loophole. It was a loophole that existed not only in South Africa, but other parts of the world. We've closed out that loophole now, but of course, there's still a period into which they need to phase. But I think the other thing that they're doing extensively is advertising. So if anyone has gone online on Google or Facebook or any of these platforms and you're looking for any piece of clothing, the first things that come up are offerings from Temu and Shein, even if one types in a South African retailer. And so they've been able to buy out all of the space. So you may say that they're exploiting an opportunity. I would say they're exploiting loopholes. And I think the first thing we need to do from a regulatory point of view is close those out. And then, of course, look, there's a part of their offering that will always appeal to the South African consumer. And I think at this stage, we're not suggesting outright bans of these platforms. But the first thing we need to do is level the playing field. And then look at how do we allow for the kind of competition and offering that such a retailer could bring, but in a way that's responsible. And that responsibility is, of course, looking at the broader economic impact.
Let's talk about leveling the playing field then. You've compared our policy response to countries like Turkey, Brazil, and India. I wonder what they're doing then that we may need to capitalize on or replicate with a degree of urgency.
I mean, it's fascinating that you mentioned Turkey as a starting point, and they, similar to France, have actually gone as far as putting bans on advertising. So that would limit the space, like I was talking about earlier, where you go on Google, you type in a piece of clothing, and the first offering you get is from Temu. France have outright banned that, and Turkey have put a cap on the spend that such advertising can do. And I think that's something that we ought to be considering in South Africa as well. Because at the moment, if you think about the convenience offering that they provide, the ordinary South African not really knowing or thinking where their clothing is coming from will first and foremost get those. But India was a really interesting example. India actually banned Shein coming into their country unless they could commit to local sourcing. And so for a period of 4 to 5 years, Shein was banned from the country until they were able to reach an agreement on building a local supply chain. And I think this is where other countries have claimed the space to add an element of, look, we have a responsibility to our citizenry. we can't just be thinking about cheap prices of clothes. We've got to think about the broader impact as well. And I think one of the risks we have with such cheap offerings is, you know, at its most extreme, it could come in and price out all of the South African retailers, all of the other offerings that you have, force them out of business, and then they might increase their prices after that. That's what you call predatory pricing. And that's one of the big worries that you have to have as a regulator around this. And it's interesting to see how much further other countries are going in the world.
I fully understand your argument. I also understand that there is a degree of altruism involved in it. But the problem with most consumers is that we don't think about that. We think about with our wallets, don't we?
Mm-hmm. And look, that's why I say there is a portion of the offering that is coming in that will appeal to consumers that have a constraints. And I think, look, we're dealing with very many constrained consumers at the moment. But we have, look, one area where we weren't able to get sufficient data and we didn't do the work is who is actually buying on Shein and Temu. And are we appealing just to consumers with more constraints, or are there other consumers, more affluent consumers, that are also buying? Look, my suspicion, and it's an anecdotal one, is that a broader array of South Africans are buying from Shein and Temu, in part because of the price point and also in part because of the convenience, because it's a platform that is a one-stop shop for a whole range of different things. And look, there's an offering that they have. Now, I think this is where I think that it's important, because there's clearly lessons that South African retailers need to learn from this. And I think we shouldn't just be looking at the likes of Shein and Temu and say, well, we want to stop them from entering in the country because they're unfair competition. There's a lot that they've done which has made them as effective as they are. So one of the things that I think is quite interesting is the way they work with their manufacturers. So there's a much greater level of engagement between Shein and Temu and their manufacturers. And this comes out in the report as well, in terms of the data that they're providing them, the access, the signaling, so that those manufacturers understand better what the consumer wants. They're able to move much, much faster. Now, the master plan, which effectively sort of underpins a lot of the work that we try to do in the clothing and textile industry, is trying to create this framework for greater collaboration between manufacturers and retailers. If anything, what this tells me is we've got to move with much greater decisiveness and much greater speed, because if South African retailers are going to compete with Shein and Temu, clearly price is going to be a thing, but it's going to be responsiveness to consumer needs and fashion. And this is an industry that moves incredibly quickly, which means having very long, complicated supply chains actually isn't the way to go. We need a much shorter supply chain, which lends itself to local manufacturing. And that's actually a bit of work that we're trying to do with the Localization Support Fund to support the industry in this.
Just a quick answer, because time is against us. What would that collaboration actually look like? And is there an appetite for it, do you think?
So there is indeed an appetite for it. So we started a program working with the retailers saying, based on where you see consumer trends going, what would you like to localize? And out of that have come a range of product categories, things like denims, athleisure, various types of knit, where they would love to localize it because of the supply chain. The next step that we've engaged in is we did a survey of manufacturers to see where's the manufacturing capacity. And now this last leg that we're into and which we're going to complete over the course of this year is a little bit of a matchmaking between the retailers. We've had a range of conversations with the likes of your TFGs, and Pick and Pay, Woolies, even H&M have been part of this, because they're also interested in how they can do so. Clearly, the things like responsiveness, price, quality, fashion all matter, but they're brought together as a holistic equation. And I think that's the work that really is required.
We'll follow this with a great deal of interest. Ashad Khatrada, thank you very much indeed, Chief Executive Officer of the Localization Support Fund.
MoneyWeb at midday, for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, let's move now from online trading to the broader economy, and the country's economy showing surprising resilience in July. That's according to the latest Banks of Africa Economic Transactions Index, which rose for the third consecutive month, pointing, one hopes, to a broad-based recovery across sectors. The index, by the way, reflects real-time economic activity based on electronic transactions, and this uptick comes despite ongoing risks like U.S. tariffs that we've been speaking about today, as well as weak global sentiment and domestic constraints. Independent economist Elise Kruger says the momentum is encouraging, but also warns that downside risks remain. Elise, a very warm welcome to you. So what does the latest index tell us about July's real economic momentum? Is it there to stay, or is there still something slowing us down?
Good afternoon, Jeremy. yes, actually, let me say it's an uptick. It's a third consecutive, as you mentioned, although the pace of increase did moderate somewhat. So we had a 0.2% monthly increase compared to the previous month, 0.4%. But still, it's an uptick. And if you compare it to 3 months ago, I mean, the index did increase nicely, really showing that there was good economic activity in the month. It really confirmed by a couple of the sectors that did better. So it seemed to have been quite broad-based.
How significant is a 1.9% year-on-year improvement in this context? It seems very small.
Yes, it's still, I would say, not such good news that one would really, you know, shoot the lights out about this figure. I would have rather expected this to be maybe slightly worse, given the fact that we are seeing a lot of, you know, uncertainty and risks out there. And I think that was a surprise of the data in the month of July, that despite what we are seeing in terms of the risky environment and uncertainty, we still had a growth in economic activity. And some sectors like vehicle sales are actually, you know, doing very well. So I think, you know, what really this tells me is there's some underlying, I would say, strength in the base of the economy that's continuing to make an impact and a difference. And I think we've got a couple of structural factors that are still positive.
But the big elephant in the room remains US tariffs, which could conceivably derail this recovery.
Yes, I do think it will be negative for growth, and I think it's already reflected in the downward revisions that we have seen in economic growth forecasts for 2025. Now, from the beginning of the year, and actually here in March, April, most economists, you know, sliced their growth forecast by about 0.5 of a percentage point due to this, you know, new, I would say, factor that will depress the economy, especially certain sectors. I think, however, that one should just, you know, keep in mind that it's not the total economy that will be harmed by the tariffs. Now, as we know, like the mining sector is mostly exempted from that. And then really a couple of those factors that I want to just mention that are still supporting the economy is to be found in the fact that we've got the lower interest rates now, about, you know, 125 basis points in lower rates in the last couple of months. If you add to that our moderate inflation numbers, you know, that feeds into a real salary increase for salary earners, you know, those are the factors that are continue to offset, or that will hopefully help to offset some of the negative impact of the tariffs.
Elise, you mentioned vehicle sales. Are there other sectors that are also showing stronger signs of life?
Well, in the month of July, we actually saw that the APSA PMI that's looking at the manufacturing sector has increased above 50 for the first time in 8 months. So these seem to have been a bit of life coming through on the manufacturing side. Slightly surprising, actually, in terms of timing, you know, just as we have all this negative news that will really impact on some of the sectors or subsectors of manufacturing. But also the broader PMI for the private sector activity also increased for a third consecutive month. So it seemed to be quite broad-based. And then obviously on the retail sales side, we've had some positive surprises. And I think that is really linked to the factors I've just mentioned. So that, you know, given that we are such a consumption-focused economy, you know, those factors are impacting on the ability of people to spend. And we continue to see a bit of life on the retail sales side as a result of that.
I like that phrase about positivity, but I'm wondering whether the momentum is enough to lift this year's GDP growth meaningfully.
Well, Jeremy, I think the best we can hope for is about 1% in terms of real GDP growth. So it's slightly above last year's numbers. But I mean, if you look at the average over the past 5 or so years, I mean, we are stuck in this 1%, I would say, muddle along type of economic growth rate, you know, which is not to be celebrated. We need a rate quite a bit higher to sustain, you know, employment in the economy, well, to create jobs. I mean, for the moment, we're just moving basically sideways in terms of our employment situation. So it is really still too low. And, you know, from that point of view, the fact that we've got another headwind in terms of the trade story, you know, is really, I would say a bummer for us, because we hoped that this year could look better. And at the end, we had to all, you know, downward revise our growth forecasts again.
Elise Kruger, economist, thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, Shell has been given the green light for what could become South Africa's deepest offshore drilling project. But the backlash has been immediate. Civil society organizations, coastal communities, have filed an appeal calling the project reckless, flawed, and potentially unlawful. Some critics arguing that Shell lacks proper emergency plans, has failed to secure consent from affected communities, and also risks violating South Africa's environmental laws as well as constitutional rights. It's a big issue. And with me now is Shahil Singh, who's legal advisor at the Green Connection, to discuss the legal challenge. So Shahil, first of all, welcome. Why is this project being called a legal and environmental red flag? Where's the big concern here?
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for having me. So there are many concerns with this project. So first of all, it's one of the deepest oil drilling projects in the world, and the deepest we've had in South Africa at over 3,000 meters. And the amount of risks of oil spills are just immense. And the thing is, the problem lies in the fact that Shell has simply not disclosed enough information to the public at large or even to the state regarding their plans with this project. Should an emergency blowout happen, how they would contain it. You know, there's just not enough information given to people.
Could you tell me what specifically is missing from oil spill contingency plans, what you're actually seeking that would perhaps mollify you to some extent?
So, for instance, there's a document called an oil spill blowout contingency plan. So this document specifically would set out what Shell would do in the event of an oil spill blowout and how they would handle it. So Shell claims to have had public participation with communities, and yes, they did have meetings and such. But this document was never disclosed. In fact, even the state didn't have access to this document. So the question here really is, how on earth did the minister approve such a project without having all the required information before them?
And a civil society organization like yours has no doubt tried to speak to the minister and to Shell itself. What response have you had?
So at this point, we filed our appeal alongside with another civil society organization called Natural Justice. We've also assisted communities in filing their own appeals. So the period for comments has been closed at the moment, and we're currently just waiting to hear back from the minister and department regarding what decision they're going to take. Because right now in our appeals, we're pushing for the minister to set aside this decision.
How many communities are potentially affected, and maybe just give us a geographical indication here?
At this point, I mean, it's so many, it's too difficult to say off the top of my head, but I mean, it affects communities all along the West Coast. And I mean, not just the West Coast alone, but that's, you know, primarily where our focus is. So along the Western Cape, Northern Cape, but there are countless other communities that could be affected as well. This is in terms of their livelihoods, especially in terms of small-scale fishing communities and coastal communities. You know, very often projects like this, they cause a great deal of inconvenience to people, and they derive their livelihoods from the ocean, and they almost never ever get any of the so-called economic benefits of a project like this.
So what legal grounds then form the basis of your appeal?
So the legal grounds are, one, public participation, that it wasn't meaningful and substantive. So the public couldn't truly include with the project and the information at hand because they didn't know what was happening. And also in terms of the project itself, regarding the oil spill blowouts, for instance, there's equipment called capping stacks, which are essentially very long metal towers that go into the water that are used to contain oil spill blowouts in the event that they do happen. But Shell doesn't have access to any equipment that could work at that level. In fact, in the entire world, I think there's only 3 capping stacks that are capable of handling those kinds of depths. And one is in the US, one is in the UK, one is in Singapore. And Shell hasn't spoken about whether they'd have access to any of those stacks should a spill happen.
What kind of ruling or response, then, are you hoping to see from the Environment Department?
We want nothing short of having the environmental authorization set aside. We don't want it to be re-looked at because we've already provided compelling information about why it shouldn't happen. So we want it to be set aside.
What type of timeline are you operating within?
At this point, it's difficult to say because the minister and the department could take some time to look at all of the information they've received. from organizations like ours as well as communities themselves. But, you know, it could be a few months, and it's difficult to say at this point.
Is there a danger that this project, when it goes ahead, could undermine South Africa's climate and Paris Agreement commitments?
Of course, yes, there is a major danger of that, because the project goes completely against South Africa's climate change and environmental objectives to move away from fossil fuel projects.
Have you engaged directly with Shell yourself as an organization?
With Shell themselves directly, not as far as I'm aware, but we have made submissions to the environmental practitioners, and we have made communications with the department as well.
Given that it looks like this project is probably a fait accompli, do you think there is any room for compromise here?
Look, I wouldn't say there is any room for compromise, because projects like this go ahead under the guise of economic development. But the reality is that most of the people who get employed to work on these kinds of projects are brought in from outside consulting companies. And, you know, the level of skills that are required are often not able to be found within the communities that are most affected. So I would say that the only way we could look at some type of compromise would be if there was, you know, great economic prosperity for the communities involved. But that almost never happens. So I'd say, no, there's no room for a middle ground or compromise.
Given that this is under legal challenge, what kind of precedent do you think it might set for future fossil fuel approvals?
Well, if the project isn't set aside, I think it could open the door for fossil fuel projects all along South Africa. And I mean, that's really not the direction we want to be headed in. We want to make it more difficult for oil and gas companies to come in because of the damage and the harm that they could potentially do. So we don't want to go in a direction where we're making it easier for them.
It's a difficult one to balance economic necessity and imperative on the one side with the environmental and community concerns that you've raised on the other, though, isn't it?
Look, I wouldn't say in this case, because even if the project goes ahead, it's not like the communities are benefiting economically. I mean, I'd understand from that perspective if there were going to be, you know, many jobs created, much economic prosperity, but for the communities that are most affected, that simply isn't the case. So, you know, the economic argument really does fall short.
Thank you very much for joining us. That's Shahil Singh, legal advisor at the Green Connection. And that's also our show for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.